happened in the U.S.
He finds out, is that it?
Welcome, everyone, to the May 5th Cinco de Mayo meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We've got a number of bills up today. We're going to do we've got a couple of honoring bills at 2185 and 3354 that we're going to do early on. And I see the speaker and a number of legislators are here on House Bill 3596, so we'll start with that and then we'll get to the others. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3596. Speaker Roblin, Senator Verger, Senator Cruz. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Joanne Verger. I serve as an Oregon Senator from District 5, which is the coastal area, and includes my hometown of Coos Bay, Oregon, where the international port of Coos Bay is located. It's my pleasure to be here today to speak on behalf of the Port of Coos Bay. It is an economic engine for the state of Oregon. We have seen growth and vitality come into the port in recent years with a wonderful past governor, Governor Kulongoski, who greatly supported the Port of Coos Bay. It is the only port in Oregon outside of the Port of Portland that is governor appointed. Their commissioners have been chosen by the governor and have done a wonderful job in Coos Bay. So I'm not going to belabor. You're going to hear today a little bit of the history of how the rail line happened to come under the ownership of the Port of Coos Bay. And we have exciting things that are happening in our future, some that you'll probably hear about and some that you won't. So with that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill and in being able to talk about the Port of Coos Bay today.
Thank you, Senator. That's a project that's been well supported by the legislature in recent times and even past times, and it's important to the state.
Yeah.
Speaker.
Well, thank you for having the opportunity to come and speak to your committee. My name is Arnie Roblin. I am a representative from District 9. It goes from Coos Bay up to Florence, a beautiful part of our state and the place where the Port of Coos Bay is located. This bill is an important part of continuing the work that both the legislature has done, the federal government has done. Our partners, Representative Congressman DeFazio, has been intimately involved. A group of legislators from the southern region of our area under the tutelage basically of Representative Susan Morgan put together a Southern Oregon Transportation Work Group, and we worked many hours together. In that time, we came to the conclusion that the Port of Coos Bay was the number one economic driver for that region for the future, and that the rail in itself was singularly the most important thing that we needed to maintain. As they closed that rail, and we saw the impact immediately on the businesses in our local area, it became even more apparent that it was something we had to take care of. And it was all the representatives in the southern region that came and put their names and their efforts behind getting the purchase of that rail line to the Port of Coos Bay. Through all of the efforts combined, we were successful with that. And then the reconstruction of the line began. And I will tell you, what came recently was the final recognition that we now have a rail line that the Port of Coos Bay owns that runs from Danabo Station in Eugene all the way to Coquille. But interestingly enough, a number of other ports are districts are aligned along that rail line, and Port District's authority is really only for their port district. And so what this bill does is it says we need to annex the rail bed from Coquille all the way to Eugene so that they can actually run it and have the authority to do that. We have talked with all of the port districts. We've talked to all the representatives in that deal, and if you look at the list of people who are signed onto this bill, it includes all of those representatives and senators whose districts this goes through. We are excited about the potential of the rail line. We have had some interest, and I think you'll hear about that later, of actually moving some stuff to Coos Bay to ship out here in the near future. So they're actually trying to get the rail up and going sooner. The goal with this last Tiger grant was to have it ready to go by September. We're hoping that we can, by June, we can start moving a few things at a very slow rate. But we actually will get this rail up to 40 miles an hour, which means you can have a single crew going there and back, which has not been the case for the last number of years. So it makes it a viable economic engine for our communities. And I'm really excited. If people know, there's a number of tunnels and 151 water crossings. This is not an easy rail line to maintain, but we have everybody in place and all the help we need to get that to happen. This is the final little piece of making that work. And we really appreciate the fact that you're hearing this bill at this time and would love your support. So thank you very much, and I'm ready to answer any questions.
Another high-speed rail line.
Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz. And compared to what it was, this is a high-speed rail line. my colleagues, I want you to know that I want to give a lot of credit to Congressman DeFazio for his work on this and for the many meetings he brought to Eugene and other parts of the state. We were all there. We've all testified. It has been an amazing collaboration of folks to get us to the point we're at now. The Port of Coos Bay, and this is about the rail line, but it's all about the Port of Coos Bay. The Port of Coos Bay in the future is going to be the economic driver of Southern Oregon. It absolutely is. It's the most accessible deep water port on the Pacific Coast. There's no question about that. And what Senator Berger mentioned or didn't mention was the opportunities in the future that exist for that port to become even more viable than it is now. But I'm suggesting for my wood products industry and for the other industries in the interior part of Southern Oregon, having that linkage to a shipping port is incredibly critical, and I would also suggest that running a train is economically viable, whereas running all those trucks across Highway 42 or Highway 38 just does not work. This is a critical component, and once we discovered that we did have this jurisdictional issue, it's an easy fix for us to do here, but it's a critical fix for the port to continue their work and to move forward with what we all think is going to be a pretty exciting future.
Great. Thank you. Is any questions? Senators and Speaker, thank you very much. We'll let
you
back to work.
Yep.
I will temporarily close the recess the hearing on HB 3596 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2185, Representative Krieger.
Chair Byron, committee members, thank you for hearing this bill today. My name is Wayne Krieger, State Rep from District 1, which is the South Coast, clear to the California border. House Bill 2185 is a request to have the new Highway 101 bridge on at Euchre Creek, named after Wilbur C. Moore, who was just over the hill, kind of a neighbor from my ranch and a place where my wife had been raised from the time she was born. I had contacted Matt Garrett regarding the process of having a bridge named, and he said they do have a process internally within the agency, but that he suggested I do it with a legislative bill and that they would not object to that. Just a little history was that 101 was built through the Moore Ranch in about 1926, the original 101. In 59 and 61, the highway was rebuilt closer to the ocean, and again it ran through the ranch, and that property had been in the family now for about 125 years. There was a book called Moore Characters and Legends and Mysteries by former legislator Walt Schroeder. Some of you may have remembered Walt. He was a great guy. And he described Wilbur as a husband, father, grandfather, outstanding livestock producer, son of pioneers, community leader, good friend, and just a few of the terms to describe Wilbur Moore of Ophir. Wilbur was always ready to help his neighbors and taught many young people about ranching. Wirbel was deeply involved in the community, serving the Ophir School Board for many years, Gold Beach Union High School Board, Curry Intermediate Education District, Ophir Water Board, Farmers Home Administration, Curry County Livestock Association, and was involved with FHA for many years. He also served as a 4-H Livestock Club leader for many years and actually held pre-fairs at his ranch to prepare his members for the county fairs. He and his wife, Ellen, were honored as Curry County Grand Marshals for the county in 2004. There are a couple of stories I could tell you, but I know you're busy today, about Wilbur and things that I'd done with him back in the time when my prior life in a blue uniform, but I won't go there for today. But Wilbur passed away September 3rd, 2008, at his home at Ophir at the age of 86. He was a true county pioneer and legend, and I would hope that you would give positive consideration to the bill to name the bridge after him.
Thank you for bringing this to us, Representative. Any questions of Representative Krueger? Seeing none, thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to speak on House Bill 2185? I don't have anybody else signed up. Seeing none, I will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2185.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2185 with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2185 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 2185 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Cruz.
Cruz. Cruz?
We'll ask
Senator Cruz if he wants to do that. It's his district. Okay, so I see Representative Cannon here, so let's see, I will close the public hearing or the work session on 2185, and we will open on House Bill 3150. Representative Cannon. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, House District 46 in Portland. Bringing to you House Bill 3150, it passed the House some time ago. Appreciate you taking it up. I know that Senator Burdick is quite familiar with this concept. I think you had a very similar bill over on this side. It relates to the ability of cities to designate certain local neighborhood streets as 20-mile-per-hour maximum speeds rather than current law, which says local neighborhood streets have to be 25-mile-per-hour. The reason for this proposal is that my city, the city of Portland, and I suspect there may be others, would like to be able to identify certain corridors as bike-friendly corridors with lower streets, with lower speeds, with other traffic calming measures. In Portland, we call these bicycle boulevards. They have been designed to help bring bicycle traffic off of arterials where they may present a challenge for drivers as well as for cyclists. They are well signed. The bill provides that to designate a street as a 20 mile per hour speed, it has to fit certain criteria, low traffic, okay, being among those, well signed being another, so that drivers are warned that this will be a somewhat different street than their ordinary neighborhood residential street. This is a safety bill, good for the children, the families like mine that like to take a Sunday afternoon cycle around the neighborhood. We have studies demonstrating that very small difference between 25-mile-per-hour speed limit and 20-mile-per-hour speed limit in neighborhood streets actually makes a significant impact on crash activity, results in a significant decrease in crash activity. So 3150 is a tool, permissive, entirely optional tool to give local governments the ability to help entice cyclists off of arterial roads and onto residential streets for the benefit of other road users, including freight, commuters, etc. There was considerable discussion in the House related to the term used to describe these streets, and our bill had the word green in it somewhere, and that proved offensive. Neighborhood greenway is what we came up with. That proved problematic for some of my colleagues. I agreed with those colleagues that I would bring to the Senate my neutrality on the idea of removing that term from the bill. So I'm perfectly happy for you to remove the offensive term Greenway from the bill. I will not object to an amendment that does that. You know, we'll deal with it on concurrence if you decide to go that route. Happy to take any questions.
So that would be the A4 amendments.
A3.
No, A4. And the A6.
And the
A3. I have, Mr. Chair, I have the A3s, which I believe are Senator Burdick's, and my understanding is that these amendments, this amendment, the dash A3, removes the term altogether, so the statute remains silent about what these are called. And I'm sure Senator Burdick will correct me if I'm misunderstanding
that. That's correct. A4 goes to the word byway, and I felt that we should leave the door open to be able to call this the Ginny Burdick bikeway.
Very good.
So, you want, so those would be the A3s, not
the A3s.
Okay. Yes?
The A6 also includes the exact same language from the A3s. So we took the A3s and incorporated them to have a nice, happy bill.
Okay. Well, we'll get to that when we go to work session. Oh, Representative, would you like to address this, the formerly known as Greenway Bill?
Chair, I'm actually here for 2275.
2275. All right.
And Mr. Chair, I haven't seen the dash A6s. There may be other amendments floating around that I haven't yet seen as well. So I don't know if you're planning to have a work session on this today. If so, I'll try to engage
really
quickly with those amendments.
We're going to have a work session on it today.
What's that?
We're going to work it today.
Okay.
Any questions of the representative? Thank you, Representative Cannon.
Thank you.
We're going to recess on 31, House Bill 3150, and we will open a public work session on House Bill 2275. Public hearing on House Bill 2275.
What about
keeping the courtesies flowing? We're being courteous, but very confusing.
Jumping all over.
Welcome. Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42. This is a very colorful committee behind you here. I miss not having my own committees in this room. It's a nice view. Happy to bring you House Bill 2275, which is the Community Engagement Act. It's a simple bill that comes to you with the unanimous approval from the House. 2275 is really about a simple principle, and you have a one-pager that's coming out before you here. At a time when we have seen near record unemployment, there are significant studies that show that in getting people into participating in volunteer activities can actually go a long ways towards not only building work skills, but building work connections, and most importantly, perhaps, building a sense of self-esteem and self-worth that then helps people get back into the job market faster. So all 2275 does is says to the department, it asks them to put a statement on their website that encourages volunteering, and the statement mimics statements that are online in other states. That particular one was cribbed with some editing from the state of New Jersey. And it also asks the department to work to make information on volunteering available during the welcome process for unemployment benefits. The bill is structured such that we are ensuring that we comply with federal law around availability of work, that we're not encumbering the unemployment system, and that we are making sure that applicants know that they need to continue to search for work and that volunteering may not impact their ability to a requirement to search for and accept employment. But along with those requirements, that they could put their skills to use in the community, and we are encouraging them to do so. It's a pretty simple bill, and we want to thank the department for working with us. Actually, after we introduced this bill, the department took many of the steps that are in the bill and has worked with us very closely on on providing just such a service to unemployed Oregonians. This bill simply ensures that it moves forward and that we're able to continue this practice. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Is there any questions for Representative Bailey? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else here? I don't have a list that wants to testify on House Bill 2275. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2275.
No.
The chair moves House Bill 2275 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair.
No, Senator Starr.
So the question I have is the bill has no fiscal impact. I don't understand how that's possible in that, it requires the Employment Department to do some work to update its website, and I don't understand how it can't, how in the world that there's no fiscal impact whatsoever. Because
it was good you haven't left. Representative, do you have an answer?
That I have to update a website, I get a bill in the mail.
Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, I'm not sure if I have to reintroduce myself for the work session, so I'll do it just in case for the record. Jules Bailey, House District 42. Great question. The answer to your question is that they have already gone about. They're already in the process of updating their website for this purpose. They reacted, actually, to this bill by doing that. So what this the reason for this bill is to get it as a policy that volunteering is encouraged and to make it as part of the welcome process. But they actually said, hey, good idea. We're going to start working on their on the website now, and they're using existing resources to do it. I'm sure the department would be happy to comment on that.
More?
Yeah, I'd like to hear from the department.
Hmm?
I'd like to hear from the department.
Do we have anybody here from the employment department? We don't have. But we do have a motion on the floor. No. Callan, would you call the roll?
Is it, or are you moving the bill?
Yes, we have a motion on the floor.
Aye.
Senator Edwards?
Aye.
Senator Drog?
No.
Senator Starr?
It's encouraging voluntary to come on.
You don't have to carry it.
I'm not going to carry it. Just, I don't see why it's necessary, but I'll vote aye.
Yes.
I'll change my vote.
Chair votes aye.
Colleagues.
House Bill 2275 is moved to the floor with unanimous support of the committee. I'll carry it. We'll adjourn the work session on House Bill 2275, and we will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3596. I have two people signed up on that, Elise Hammer, I think it's Hammer, and Brian Craig. Please come forward.
What's your bill?
First one.
Good bill on the list. Good bill. It's a great bill.
We're going to do the inner building.
You could just hold up your lapel. That probably would be enough. Please.
Hi. Thank you, Chairman Beyer and committee members. My name is Elise Hamner, and I'm with the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. I send the apology from our Chief Operating Officer of the Railroad, Dan Lovelady. He's meeting today with Federal Railroad Administration officials in Coos Bay. Should I continue? To start with, the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay has been the recipient of tremendous regional, state, and federal support in our effort to purchase and rebuild this rail line. Passage of House Bill 3596 would allow for legal clarification that's required for ownership and operation of the line, and we're requesting your help to do this. I don't know if you know the history, but Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad operated the line for several years. They closed it in 2007, saying that the tunnels were unsafe. At the time, shippers along the rail line employed 750 people in what I like to call living wage jobs. Employment today in those companies along the rail line has dropped to between 430 and 450 people. Thanks to the advocacy on the part of the business sector, the shippers, and our legislative partners, the port won the U.S. Surface Transportation Board's approval to purchase the line in 2009, and we've completed those transactions. The Port of Coos Bay now owns all 133 miles of infrastructure. We've also received more than $25 million in state and federal grant money, which we will be using to rehabilitate the line. That includes all 9 tunnels, the bridges, and the track infrastructure. We're scheduled to open the railroad to partial service in late June or early July, with anticipation of full service being restored in September. So, House Bill 3596 proposes to empower the port to own and operate the railroad line between the city of Coquille in Coos County and Eugene or Danabo here in Lane County. So what that means is we can annex the railroad corridor into the port district. It would also give the port the ability to annex industrial lands contiguous to the rail line right-of-way, but only if landowners approve or request that. I think it's important that everyone know this legislation gives the port no power to do a forced annexation. It's only at a landowner's request. Technically, annexation of the rail line would allow us to enact ordinances, which we feel is important when it comes to safety issues. For instance, the port conceivably would want to ask our commission for permission to enact ordinances that pertain to rail worker safety and maintenance operations along the rail line, nowhere off of our corridor. Also, the Port of Coos Bay, being a special district, has access to low-interest financing and economic development tools, which we feel could be beneficial to a company should it choose to have its industrial lands annexed to the rail line, in helping them perhaps expand or develop businesses. In closing, I'd like to say that the port requests your help in helping us get through this final legal step. We own the rail line, but there are some ambiguities in state law. We'd like to clear that up so that it's clear that we can own and operate it and, again, restore that transportation link that's crucial for Southwest Oregon, connecting us to the rest of the nation.
Thank you, Lisa. Any questions? Fine.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Krieg, and I'm here today representing the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 932. 932 is headquartered in Coos Bay, servicing the South and Central Coasts. And as you noted, Chair Beyer, it's essential, the port and the rail line, to the economic health of our area, and this bill for us is about jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Brian? Seeing none, thank you both very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3596? I got to see a thumbs up from the rail administration back there, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3596 and open a work session on House Bill 3096.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 3096 to floor.
3596. Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill. Excuse me?
Go ahead.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 3596 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. No discussion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 3596 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I think we'll ask Senators Berger and Cruz to carry that. Shortly carry that. All right, now we're back to, we have no more legislators in the room, so we go back to, let's reopen a public hearing on House Bill 3150. And I think we've heard that, so is there anybody, I guess there's a whole bunch of people who want to testify on 3150.
Do you want me to read it into the record?
Yes, go ahead.
Senate Bill 3150 authorizes a road authority to designate speeds on neighborhood greenways 5 miles per hour lower than the statutory speed limit and defines neighborhood greenways. I also have an A3 amendment that basically does the same thing but removes the bill, removes the term neighborhood greenway. I also have an A4 amendment which changes the word greenway to byway. Both the A3 and A4 amendment, there's no fiscal and no revenue impact. I also just received before the meeting an A5 amendment and an A6 amendment. I don't know what those do, and I have not yet received a revenue or fiscal impact on those amendments.
Oh, so we can't hear the bill today.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we'll hear from Tom Miller and Rob Birchfield and Jonathan Maton. Manton.
Oh, John. You're killing me.
Okay. Take it away.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, committee members. My name for the record is Tom Miller, Director of Transportation for the City of Portland. I appreciate your consideration of this this important bill before you. You heard from Representative Cannon, and I appreciate his support in the House for this. I appreciate Senator Burdick's support thus far, and I appreciate your consideration of this effort. In the interest of your time, rather than recite what you heard from Representative Cannon, I'll just maybe try to complement that with just a few key points. For us, the key reason why we seek to reduce, why we seek the discretion to reduce motor vehicle speeds down to 20 miles an hour is really based on a Federal Highway Administration analysis that shows that a pedestrian struck by a motor vehicle at 30 miles an hour stands a 40% chance of being killed. But if that same pedestrian struck at 20 miles an hour stands just a 5% chance of being killed. So 10% motor vehicle speed reduction results in a significant chance of reducing the likelihood of fatality. So that difference, again, based on Federal Highway Administration analysis, is really the key to our interest in this effort here. Again, you heard some of that from Representative Cannon, and that's just a little bit more detail about why this is important from our perspective. You also heard that it reduces conflicts between people on foot, people on bike, people in motor vehicles, whether you're in a truck delivering freight or whether you're in a motor vehicle. Again, the City of Portland, as other cities and other communities in Portland have done, we've been trying to shift the non-motorized movement to these neighborhood greenways, byways, whatever you want to call them. We've been trying to shift them to parallel streets adjacent to the arterials that are really necessary for freight and other motor vehicle movements. And that effort has been supported by our Freight Advisory Committee, AAA, various trucking organizations, and the Portland Business Alliance. So, again, this has been an effort that has been underway for some time. We've worked to gather support from a wide range of stakeholders, and we appreciate your consideration.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today regarding House Bill 3150. For the record, I'm Rob Birchfield, City Traffic Engineer for the City of Portland's Bureau of Transportation. The purpose of my testimony today is to provide the committee with some additional detail regarding how this bill would work. The legislation is limited to roads and residence districts that have relatively low traffic volumes and low speeds. The bill specifically restricts the application to streets that have less than 2,000 vehicles per day on them. That's a modest traffic volume, and one that would be qualify in most of our neighborhood streets in cities around the state. The speed requirement is that the 85th percentile speed on the street has to be less than 30 miles per hour. An 85th percentile speed of less than 30 miles per hour means that 85% of the motorists are going less than or equal to 30 miles per hour. So this is the types of streets on the left that we would consider appropriate for the use of the 20 mile per hour regulation. The street on the right is more the type of arterial street that we recognize has the most conflicts and isn't the safest place for people who want to be away from high speed traffic and the conflicts with motor vehicles. The streets where this would be applied have to indicate the presence of pedestrians or bicyclists. So here's an example of some types of marking and signing that could be used to do this. The legislation is, the language is general, so there's a variety of options that a municipality could use to designate or sign for the presence of pedestrians and bicycles. In order for the regulation to be in effect, it must be signed. So quite simply, in order for the 20-mile-per-hour regulation to be enforced, there must be a sign at the start of the segment and at key points along the stretch that tells people that it's a 20-mile-per-hour street. So that's very straightforward. And finally, what I would draw your attention to is this example. This is on the left, the street marked in red is 82nd Avenue, and you see the markings there show locations of pedestrian and bicycle crashes. The type of opportunity we would have with this legislation is then to mark a parallel street as one of these byway streets where we would institute the 20-mile-per-hour regulation and take pedestrians and bicyclists on a route that helps them avoid the conflicts and potential hazards of that major street. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The question I have is enforcement of the current laws, and the reason I bring that up is I have to tell you that someone that's from rural Oregon that goes up to the Blazer games, bicycle riders in Portland, have no regard whatsoever for riding in any proper lane, not going on sidewalks, not going with the flow of traffic, and yet we try to kind of change the world for them, but doesn't it seem reasonable that we ask that the traffic laws for them be enforced in the city of Portland?
We hear a lot about that in Portland as well, and we work closely with our police to do traffic enforcement, and we organize special missions basically to do that. Basically, the strategy that we use is when we go out to a location that has been identified as a problem location with non-compliance, then what police do is they write citations for everybody. They write citations for cars that fail to stop at a stop sign, they write citations for cyclists, and they write citations for pedestrians as well. So the approach we take is that everybody should respect and obey the laws, and our enforcement strategy is to support that.
What? I think it would be an observation. I'm not sure your enforcement strategy is working if that's the case. You can pick any day and go up there, and at 5 o'clock, bicyclists are going between cars. They have their own set of laws, and it's extremely frustrating. That's just an observation.
Jonathan.
Chair, by our members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here today representing the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. Just want to offer our support for this bill and appreciate the work that's been done beforehand on it. I think that it is an effort to reduce conflict and the kind of conflicts and issues that Senator Drott was just mentioning is something that, you know, we would certainly like to help with, and it doesn't do anybody any good to not obey the law. And what we particularly appreciate about this proposal is that if the cities want to do it themselves, to put these roadways in, that we think that it does reduce conflict, and we are working very hard to try to accomplish that goal on a number of fronts. And so I just wanted to go on the record and indicate our support for this bill and appreciation for those who have worked on it to this point.
Any questions? Thank you very much. And let's see. Troy. There we go.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Troy Costales, Administrator of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And, Mr. Chair, I'm just here in relationship to the A-A5s and then A6s that were just released a few minutes ago, wanting to ask if our quick interpretation of these amendments match up with what the intent of the amendments would be, particularly in relationship to the interstate speed piece of those amendments. Our interpretation is that it keeps the decision of any potential interstate speed limit change with the department via the Transportation Commission for rule, and that this is not something that is coming forward in relationship to a mandatory change of this, of the speed limits on the interstates.
Senator Hutchinson, do you want to address that?
Sure, let me consult with Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
The intent, I believe, of the amendment is to mandate a 75-mile-an-hour speed limit on the interstates. And as we look at the amendment, the deletion of Section C on page 2, I believe, was the attempt to do that. If we, or should I say, if council didn't quite get it done that way, then I think that it would be the intention to create a mandate for the speed limit would be increased as opposed to providing discretion to the department. We've seen what providing discretion to the department has yielded drivers in Oregon. I don't believe that's the intention of the drafters.
So, Senator, let me ask you. So the intent was where we have a maximum speed limit now on the interstate of 65 and on highways, I think it's on state highways, it's 55. The intent was to raise that number to 75, but still allow the department the discretion as they have now to lower it in sections where there's like a curve or something like that?
I believe that's correct. And also, say, in the city of Portland where I-5 and I-4, on the interstates through, you know, through populated areas.
Have that lower?
Yeah.
So I guess I would ask you, Troy, since you're likely to be the one that would advise the commission, you do not read it that way?
Mr. Chair, I do not interpret that due to page 1, lines 19 and beyond, where it says may establish.
Right.
And, Mr. Chair, that's why I come forward to ask for the clarification.
Perhaps the drafters of the amendment want to consider this some more. Okay. Do you have further commentary?
No further testimony, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Great. Is there anybody else who wishes? That's all I have on the list. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on 3596, and I think we will not. Work session. 3150. Boy, I'm having a real roll on here. 3150. And we're going to then open on, let's see, what have I got next here? We don't have the representatives, so I guess we're going to go to we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2081. Richard.
2081. Senate Bill 2081 creates offense of unlawfully idling primary engine of commercial vehicles. It prohibits idling in front of schools. It prohibits local governments from enacting or enforcing any local regulation regarding the idling of primary engine in commercial vehicles. I also have a dash 8 amendment, which allows the idling if the outside temperature is over 75 degrees and an auxiliary power unit provides heating only. I also have a dash 9 amendment, which removes provisions stating that the measure supersedes or preempts any local regulation regarding the idling of primary car engines. And I also have a dash 11 amendment, which allows local regulations regarding idling of primary engines in commercial vehicles to be enforced by local governments if the regulation was in effect before January 1st.
So we've got 8 and 11 and a what?
And a 9.
I was thinking that.
And they all have minimal fiscal and no revenue impacts. I also have public testimony from the Intergovernmental Relationships Manager from Lane County in opposition unless amended.
Okay. Bob Russell.
Good afternoon. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2081. Let me give you a little bit of history and sort of how this came about. You may recall House Bill 2196 from the 2009 session that was introduced by DEQ. That bill had three parts to it. It had a low carbon fuel standard. It had a provision that would have granted rulemaking authority to DEQ to regulate truck idling, and it would have also granted rulemaking authority to DEQ to require truck efficiency measures, which are aerodynamic devices, low rolling resistance tires, and those kinds of things. When that bill came over here, the two truck pieces were turned into a study. And during the interim between the 09 session and this session, DEQ created a task force, and it was very balanced. There were a number of folks representing trucking companies and trucking suppliers to the trucking industry, and we met for a number of months, and DEQ did a report, and they introduced House Bill 2081 as a result of that, or at least the original version. The original version of 2081 would have done basically the same things for trucking that 2196 did in 09. It would have provided broad rulemaking authority to develop a truck idling regulation and rulemaking authority for the truck efficiency pieces. When the bill was in the House Business and Transportation Committee, it was amended and the DEQ provisions were replaced with what is before you today. So I will be brief as in my testimony on what this is. Currently we have 30 states or local jurisdictions within those states that have truck idling regulations. The American Trucking Association supports states adopting truck idling regulations as part of a sustainability initiative. Of course, truck idling regulations are designed to reduce fuel and thereby reduce emissions from commercial trucks. Rather than do the section by section, and because I know we're running short of time, let me sort of hit the highlights. Any regulation like this that we do has some complexity to it because of the diversity within the trucking industry itself. And so we're transporting 75% of the total tons of freight in the state. We're basically serving the entire economy. So the industry is as diverse as the economy. So coming up with a single regulation that would apply to everyone in the trucking industry is very, very difficult. So what we did is we started with a basic regulation that you cannot idle for more than 5 minutes in any 60-minute period. And from there, we developed a number of exemptions that would reflect different parts of the trucking industry. For example, cement mixers, they use their primary engines to turn the drums on the cement truck. If they don't, if those drums don't turn, then the cement turns to concrete. So they have to continue to idle their engine as long as that truck is loaded with cement. Trucks that are carrying perishable products, they're using their primary engine in many instances to provide refrigeration to make sure that those products stay cool and they
they don't deteriorate. So there's an exemption for that kind of stuff. We have exemptions for government vehicles, for emergency vehicles, for all kinds of things that necessarily have to idle their trucks. One of the things that we did with this regulation, which is unusual for me, usually when I come to you, I'm talking to you about trucks over 26,000 pounds. In this particular case, this idling regulation starts with trucks at 10,000 pounds and up. And the reason that we did that is during the DEQ task force, Don Emerson from FMI, that sells about 80% of the medium-duty trucks in the state, he told us stories about some of the folks that were operating those smaller trucks. They were basically leaving them on all day long. They weren't turning them off at all, and when they would bring them in for service, he would download the data off of the electronic control module and say, do you know that you've run about 200 miles a day and you are idling your truck for 7 hours a day? And they said, well, we thought you had to leave a diesel on all the time. It wasn't good for it to turn it off. And that's one of the old wives' tales in the trucking industry. 30 years ago, that may have been true, but today's diesel engines are certainly designed to be turned off and turned back on again. So because of his experience, we thought that we could make a significant impact on the idling of those medium-duty trucks, so we included them in our proposal. Another feature of this proposal is that it goes into the Motor Vehicle Code and it's enforceable with a uniform traffic citation. That means any law enforcement officer in the state with a ticket book can enforce it. That's a big part of the reason that we don't have a fiscal on this bill. DEQ, when they had their regulation, unless they had additional changes to statute, they would have had to enforce it with the civil monetary penalty, which is the authority that they have today. And once they got their program up and running, they would have had to come back and ask for additional staff to enforce their truck idling regulation. By doing it this way, it doesn't require any additional people, and it doesn't have a fiscal, because existing law enforcement can enforce it. One of the things that was perhaps the most challenging to deal with is you folks know that we are subject to hours of service regulations that from the federal government, and we have to take 10 hours off every day, and we can only work 14. And a lot of our folks live in their trucks, and they sleep there. And so what do you do to keep them comfortable? That's their home. The approach that we took was patterned after the proposal that DEQ originally came up with, and we created a temperature band, and it said if it's colder than this, then you can idle, and if it's warmer than that, then you can idle to provide air conditioning. DEQ's original proposal said that the lower limit would be 35 degrees and the upper 75 degrees. Quite frankly, we thought it was not reasonable to expect somebody to sleep in what is basically a tin can at 35 degrees, so we raised that limit to 50 degrees. So if someone is sleeping in their truck, taking their required time off, then they can idle their truck if it's colder than 50 or warmer than 75 to provide the necessary heating or air conditioning.
Bob, is there a time limit on, do you think it's going to be that temperature, too hot or too cold, or is it an average temperature? Or?
You know, the way the bill is written, it is if we hit that temperature. It seemed too difficult to expect law enforcement to anticipate what the average temperature was going to be during a 10-hour period. So they can check a thermometer, and if it's under 50 degrees, then they can idle, and if it's over 75, then they can idle. So it's point-specific. Other states have taken different approaches. Many of them have basically said that you can idle all you want during your sleep and rest period. We chose not to do that. We also, which is unique for idling regulations around the country, we said that if you have an auxiliary power unit that will provide the heating and air conditioning, or if the truck stop has what we call truck stop electrification, they have the facilities where you can hook the truck up and provide heating and air conditioning that way, then you must use it. You can't idle the truck. We also have a preemption of local government regulations so that this would create a single uniform regulation across the state. We picked this up from DEQ's bill. It had exactly the same preemption language in it, and I'll get back to that because I know that there's been quite a bit of discussion about that in the last couple of days. Finding the right answer to truck idling is not as simple as I once thought. We looked at all the regulations across the country, and attached to my testimony you have a summary of every regulation that exists in the country today. And we tried to thread the needle. Certainly what we're proposing is less stringent than some regulations, and it's more stringent than others. For example, California, if you've got a 2007 truck or newer, there are no idling regulations. Their idling regulations only apply for on older trucks. And I think we've talked before about how the trucking industry has been upgrading its engines over a period of years that to comply with EPA requirements. The 2007 engine was the engine that has particulate traps that reduced 95% of particulate matter in diesel exhaust. We have a new generation in 2010, and that one drops the NOx by 95%. One of the things that I often say is that the exhaust from a 2010 truck is cleaner than the air in downtown Portland, so that we're going to route the exhaust into the cabs of our trucks to improve our drivers' health. So they're very clean-burning engines, but one of the things that it doesn't affect is carbon. And since part of the impetus behind this regulation, at least from DEQ's perspective, was to reduce carbon, we did not put that exemption in our proposal. You know, there are basically three different ways that you can reduce truck idling. You know, sort of the biggest incentive of all is the price of fuel. Right now, diesel is averaging over $4 a gallon. It has become the single largest cost that a trucking company must bear. It has exceeded the cost of labor. We don't want to idle. We don't want to burn the fuel. It's very, very expensive. Most of my members already have their own truck idling policies in place. Sort of the second way that we can reduce idling, and Senator Burdick, this is an advertisement for the Betsy, is that we can put the auxiliary power units on our trucks. And the Betsy helps us with the 35% tax credit today, and that dramatically helps us reduce idling. And the third way is basically with a regulation, which is exactly what we're proposing here. The last couple of days, there has been a lot of discussion about the preemption provision in this bill, so I'd like to spend a little bit of time on that. Some of you may be aware that in a prior life, I was a regulator. I worked for the Public Utility Commission back in the days when we had responsibility for transportation regulations, and I was responsible for regulating the trucking and rail industries. When we were promulgating new regulations, one of the first things that we looked at was, are we doing something that it's reasonable to expect that somebody will comply with what we're asking them to do? Before you talk about enforcement, you want to design the regulation for compliance. If you can communicate it clearly and it's uniform, it doesn't change from place to place, then you have a much higher percentage of compliance, which is what you're after in the first place before you start actually doing the enforcement. One of our goals here is to have a single uniform regulation across the state, which we believe will significantly help with compliance with the idling regulation. The trucking industry is a bit more challenging than others when you're talking about these kinds of things, because most of the trucks, in fact, reside out of state. So communicating with them and explaining the regulations becomes quite a challenge. Just to give you an example, for the trucks over 26,000 pounds, we have 41,000 that are based in Oregon. We have 242,000 that are based out of state that operate regularly in Oregon. So the vast majority of trucks are located throughout North America, quite frankly, and soon to be Mexico. So that's one point, is that if we have a uniform regulation, compliance will be higher and it will make it much easier for folks to take care of. The second thing is that in 2009, in part of House Bill 2001, we passed a provision that deals with metropolitan planning organizations and asked them to reduce vehicle miles of travel as part of the Greenhouse Gas Initiative. That was followed up in the February session with House Bill 1059. Both of those bills, the requirements for MPOs, were for vehicles 10,000 pounds and less. So this regulation in no way conflicts with the direction that you have provided to the MPOs. However, 1059 also had a required the Department of Transportation to develop a statewide strategy for dealing with greenhouse gases. I sit on that task force that's chaired by Transportation Commissioner Achterman, and certainly truck idling would be one of those things that we would consider as part of this, the statewide strategy. Again, DEQ had the language I just lifted out of their bill, so they had it. They understood the necessity for it. From our perspective, we understand the needs of local government. What we're really asking for is a statewide uniform standard, but by providing the uniform traffic citation as the enforcement mechanism, we're giving local governments the ability to enforce the regulation and asking them to join us as partners in making this an effective regulation statewide. So local governments certainly have a role and certainly have the ability to prioritize truck idling as something that they would like their local law enforcement to enforce. There's also been some discussion about policies, whether local government policies for their own vehicles are covered under this preemption language, and I certainly want to assure you that they are not. Our companies have policies. Our shippers have policies about truck idling. We did not want to preempt those in any way. I do have an amendment that I would like to offer that perhaps will help on the preemption issue, and that's the dash A11. And basically what it does is it grandfathers in anything that's in existence today. We know that Ashland has a regulation. This certainly takes care of Ashland's issue. We have heard in the last day or so that other jurisdictions may have policies or various other things that they're concerned about. All of those things would be grandfathered in if they were enacted prior to January 1st. So I would recommend to you that you add that to the bill. I also have another technical amendment, which is the dash A8. When we set up the enforcement mechanism with this uniform traffic citation, we said that law enforcement could issue the ticket to the driver or to the owner of the vehicle or both. By using the term owner, we inadvertently picked up leasing companies. We have a lot of our folks get their trucks from leasing companies that continue to own the truck, but they in no way have anything to do with the operation. So what this does is it changes owner to motor carrier to make it clear that it's the company that's operating the truck that's subject to the citation. The other change has to do with the temperature variation that I talked about earlier and the definition of auxiliary power unit. There are some companies that have APUs that only provide heat. They do not provide cooling. So what this amendment does is it says they can't idle unless it, if the temperature is low. They can only idle if it's over 75 degrees to provide the air conditioning, because their APU does not provide that facility to them. So I would also offer the A8 amendment to take care of those two issues. With that, I would like to thank DEQ and the Oregon Environmental Council. I've worked closely with both of them through the development of this bill. The Oregon Environmental Council and I have an agreement that we are going to continue to work on the truck idling into the future, and we will monitor the success of this regulation, and in the event that we need to make changes to this regulation, we will work together to come back to you and make those changes. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Bob. Senator Bates is here. He needs to testify. You want to hang on just a second?
Okay.
Let Senator Bates speak and then see if anybody has any questions. I know you need to get back to Ways and Means, Senator Bates, but I want to give you the opportunity if you'd like. Sure.
Thanks, Sam.
You go first, I'll go second.
Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Ann Seltzer, and I'm here representing Ashland. You have a copy, or you will have a copy shortly, of a letter addressed to you from Ashland Mayor John Stromberg. And I'm not going to read the letter out loud, but I did want to highlight some significant points. As stated in the mayor's letter, Ashland has had an ordinance in place since 2002, which is similar to HB 2081 in that it prohibits idling of commercial vehicles. But unlike HB 2081, it prohibits idling of commercial vehicles for more than 5 minutes, regardless of the weather. Our ordinance reduces greenhouse gas and other emissions, but it is also about parking and noise. It is a good neighbor ordinance and helps residents and businesses live and work in close proximity. Ashland has a number of mixed-use neighborhoods. Many Ashland residents live adjacent to or near local businesses, and commercial vehicles must deliver products and services to the businesses, but leaving their motors idling is loud and disruptive to the nearby residents. Enforcement is driven by complaint. It rarely occurs, and when it does, I know of occasions when a business or a resident has asked a driver to turn off the motor, and the driver's done so without rancor. Many drivers have been making deliveries in Ashland for many years and are well aware of the ordinance. It's rare the city receives complaints, but the times when we do have to enforce the ordinance, the drivers are generally amenable. If HB 2081 passes as written, Ashland would be unable to enforce its own ordinance and potentially risk conflict between businesses and neighbors. Ashland would prefer the preemption language in Section 6 be struck, but if that's not possible, Ashland respectfully requests you amend the bill to grandfather in our local ordinance and allow Ashland to continue to manage vehicle emissions and the healthy relationship between our businesses and residents. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
It sounds like it's a nuisance problem, our ordinance, typical municipal nuisance. So how do you, have you ever had any issues with, like, cement trucks?
They would get a noise permit. So through the construction company, they go through the permit process. It's just a regular part of the building.
They do that?
Mm-hmm. ODOT requests noise permits when they're doing overlays or work on Highway 99, for example, that goes right through our community.
I was thinking more about like home building or sidewalks or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
It works.
Senator Bates?
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, for the record, Alan Bates, State Senator for District 3, and Ashland is where I live half the time. The other half the time I live in Medford, and I can't quite decide where I'm going to be living this next year. So it looks like it's probably going back to Ashland. That said, Ashland has some unique characteristics that you may not be aware of. I know everyone thinks of Ashland as being very unique, and it is. But there's some things that I want you to be aware of when you consider the A11 amendments to this bill, which stops a preemption. Ashland is a town of about 20,000 people nestled in a valley which is surrounded on all sides by mountains. And those 20,000 people are in an area that's very compact, very few streets. You can walk in most places you need to go. And 250,000 people come there every year to go to the Shakespearean Festival and take part in the joy and fun of seeing how we live in Ashland. That's a lot of people coming in on a lot of buses and tour buses and vehicles. Because of our air quality shed in the Rogue Valley, which is the second worst on the West Coast, this is an important thing for us to control. If you ever come to Mount Ashland in the winter, look back down at the city of Ashland in our valley, it's a gray haze most of the time on clear days because of our air shed and our air quality. We can't change that. That's the geography of where we live. So it's important that we don't have trucks idling any longer than is necessary. Now, I'm not going to tell you that the average summer temperature in Ashland being about 95 degrees, those tour buses come in, we make them turn off their things, temperature rises in the bus, people have to leave and go out and spend money in our city. I'm not saying that happens. I'm not suggesting it happens, but it could. So that's another reason for doing this. Another thing that happened is very strange that I didn't realize until I actually saw it myself. About five or six times a year, the Siskiyou Summit is closed. That's I-5 going south. Completely closes for anywhere up to 5 to 25 hours. And trucks start piling up so fast you can't believe it. Hundreds of trucks are piled up there and can't get off the freeway. And where they usually go is into Ashland. And when you drive into Ashland those evenings and those nights when the storms are hitting, you'll find street after street after street filled with all these trucks. And it's a very collaborative thing. Nobody gets upset. You know, you're sitting here in your front room and looking out at 18-wheelers everywhere up and down the streets. And you've seen this as I have. And we don't mind them being there. They have no choice. But we like to have their engines not running, because it really can cause problems both for noise and for the quality of the air. So for all those reasons, the ones Anne has told you about, we really ask that you do the A11 exemption. It sounds to me like there's a consensus on this. I'd hope you look on the A11 amendments favorably. And I like any question I could take, I'd be glad to take now.
Thank you. Any questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you. Let's get back to work.
Thank you very much.
We want you to fix that budget.
Yes, sir.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee.
Before I go on, is there any questions, Bob? Doesn't look like it, Bob.
Oh, I got one.
Oh, you got one. Gerard. Senator Gerard.
Yeah, there's the -9 amendments, too. I mean, are those the two that you gave, the 11s and the 8s, you're okay with? The other ones you're not okay with? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerard, as I read the 9s, what they do is they take the preemption provision out altogether.
Okay.
And no, I'm not okay with that.
Okay.
Anything else? Thank you, Bob. All righty. Let's see. Lisa Arkin, Mary Pivetto, and Ellison Gutzman.
Thank you. Thank you very much, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Arkin. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Toxics Alliance, and I am from Eugene, Oregon. My organization, Oregon Toxics Alliance, has worked on the Healthy Air Oregon campaign for more than 4 years. One of the outcomes of our work is the state no top-off law, which was overwhelmingly supported by the Oregon legislature and became law in 2009 to protect worker health and public health and to prevent waste of gasoline. We also serve as partners to the Department of Environmental Quality on the Portland Air Toxic Solution Advisory Committee, and we have received a grant from the EPA to work on air toxics in local communities. Local no idling initiatives are essential to raising awareness about the dangers of diesel particulate exposure and greenhouse gases, and how to take very simple steps that can make a positive impact for clean air. Over 30 Oregon businesses have officially endorsed no idling policies for their own operations and their vendors. These include banks, supermarkets, car rental agencies, and hospitals, even the Portland Trailblazers. These business owners were inspired to take action because they care about their local community and they want to take a leadership role to improve air quality and public health. While such policies carry no legal weight, they do establish voluntary standards and have helped steer local governments to do their part to reduce air emissions from idling trucks and cars. For example, in Eugene, a multi-year stakeholder process has carefully and deliberately recommended certain actions to achieve the goals in the City Council adopted Community Climate and Energy Action Plan. Idling policies will likely be among the recommendations. So I'd like to state that it's not only the city of Ashland that has unique air issues and community health concerns. The city of Eugene does as well. We also live in a bowl. We're surrounded by mountains, and we have a number of poor air quality days. And in our case, it's not so much visitors who are there, maybe visiting 1 or 2 days, but people who live there day after day, year after year, raise their families there, and their home may be in close proximity to a business or an industrial corridor. So the city of Ashland has every right to need an exemption, but that should not exclude other cities who need to move in the same direction as Ashland. I urge you not to discourage local efforts to set air quality standards by signaling that such efforts, if enforced, are illegal. It is often at the local level where innovation and good policy is first developed, later to be adopted by society as a whole. If you hear the argument, as you have, that Oregon needs a uniform law so that truckers know what idling standards apply, I can assure you that cities and counties and private businesses are doing an excellent job at creating visible signage and driver education programs. The compliance piece is actually rather simple. Drivers go state to state and have to deal with different laws across state lines all the time. Market of Choice, a Oregon-based supermarket, has had no trouble with enforcing their no-idling policy with their vendors, and they found that it has made a better atmosphere for workers and customers alike. The Portland Trailblazers have a very strict no-idling policy to protect people in the stadium from inhaling fumes which would come in through the HVAC system for trucks parked in the vicinity. Included in my packet is a model policy from the Eugene Water and Electric Board. They have invested a great deal of time and money to educate their drivers, even those drivers that run equipment on their trucks, because they make appropriate exemptions for that. I have attached that so that you can study it. It's an excellent innovation, excellent example of innovation and leadership at the local level. I'd like to point out that the preemption language in Section 6 signals that EWEB's stellar initiative to protect their drivers and their customers from harmful diesel exhaust might be inappropriate, potentially illegal. I also want to resubmit for the record, and it's attached to my testimony, original testimony presented by the Oregon Environmental Council when this bill was heard in the House Transportation and Development Committee. I urge you to read their original testimony again. They accurately describe the significant problems with this bill and point out the unnecessary negative impacts of a local government preemption. In an effort to get a small concession to protect children on school grounds, OEC made a regretful agreement to not oppose this bill on the Senate side. Their original analysis of HB 2081 still presents an accurate and complete picture of why this bill is but a shadow of the legislation first proposed by the DEQ. And let me read a brief excerpt from the Oregon Environmental Council testimony submitted on March 23, 2011. HB 2081 was developed by pulling together a task force of stakeholders and represents a fair, economical, feasible way to move forward. However, the proposed amendments in HB 2081A significantly watered down idling provisions. Passing the gut and stuff version of this bill would be a feeble gesture with respect to reducing Oregon's dependence on oil and doing our part to help curb climate change. OEC is also opposed to preempting local governments from enacting stronger provisions. We can accept the preemption in the original DEQ bill because the provisions are strong, but not in the amended bill because the bill's too weak. Also, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, as introduced, would have required rulemaking provisions to allow the Environmental Quality Commission to set comprehensive standards for statewide no idling. Those provisions were removed from the original bill. The lack of local flexibility turns a beneficial bill into a restrictive legislation and curtails public input, not a very democratic process. The preemption language affecting local governments prevents them from addressing any deficiencies in this bill that might have been addressed during rulemaking. The bill dampens input and local incentives for idling technologies. Idling alternative technologies such as truck stop electrification and truck retrofits create jobs in Oregon because opportunities will arise to design, build, and install these equipments, and this bill contains no incentive or phase-in for these alternatives to technology. For example, in Lane County, there's a company called Cascade Sierra Solutions that designs these kinds of idling alternative equipment. They would be better suited by the original DEQ bill. So in closing, I'd like to state that we are pleased that House Bill 2081 helps Oregon truckers make incremental steps toward complying with Oregon policies on reducing greenhouse gases and fuel consumption. However, we urge this Senate to omit Section 6, and this is the -9 amendments, which preempts city and county efforts to reduce air toxics for the benefit of local communities. It is the local communities, often in crowded neighborhoods, that abut commercial and industrial areas that bear the brunt of harmful truck idling exhaust and negative health outcomes for the children, for the elderly, and for those who are health impaired. I hope that you will read the testimony submitted by agency, governments, and educational institutions and consider those in your work session that address the preemption in Section 6 and the desire that that not be there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon. Mary Pivato from Portland, Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the rest of the committee for providing this opportunity to speak to you today regarding HB 2081, the commercial truck idling legislation bill. As the founder and president of Neighbors for Clean Air and as a citizen representative on the Portland Air Toxic Solutions Advisory Committee, specifically charged with making rule recommendations that address localized impacts of toxic air pollution, I am a sign-on to the letter you have received or will receive from Lisa Arkin, Executive Director of Oregon Toxics Alliance, and I agree strongly with the recommendations that the amendments, specifically Section 6, which preempt local jurisdiction, should be removed.
but I wanted to come here today to speak to you as an Oregon citizen and a parent of three daughters concerned about the high concentrations of toxic pollution in our cities and the effect that has on my and my children's future health, which is the perspective that drives all of my engagement on air pollution regulation. While I am horrified to learn that my daughter's schools are ranked among the bottom 2% in the nation due to toxic industrial air pollution, and that more than 100 Oregon schools are situated in equally dangerous toxic hotspots, I want to say I am an optimist, confident that my trust in our leaders to keep the health and well-being of our children at the center of your work to manage the business of pollution is well placed. I have a story of idling trucks that I hope will illustrate why local jurisdiction is so important to protect our children's well-being. The language in this bill is very vague when it comes to addressing trucks in school zones. In fact, it allows for so many exemptions as to be nearly toothless. I live in Northwest Portland, which is said to be the highest density residential neighborhood in the city. We regularly share our residential streets with industry traffic, retail traffic, and the higher passenger vehicle traffic associated with the bustling activity of a healthy, vibrant urban community. Chapman Elementary School, where all my children have attended or currently attend, is the iconic heart of the neighborhood surrounded by a public park that caters to any and all, whether they bring their dog, come to play basketball, soccer, other sports, watch the seasonal migration of the swifts, or, as hundreds do every day, walk their kids to and from school. Just two blocks from Chapman is the Friendly House Community Center, where in a small daylight basement room operates a phenomenal Head Start preschool program that two of my daughters also attended. Across the street from the entrance to the preschool is a neighborhood convenience store. On many occasions, either in the morning dropping off or midday pickup, I encountered idling trucks parked directly in front of the door of the preschool, while their drivers ran into the convenience store to deliver products. The small residential street is not well suited to these trucks. I started to become more concerned about this issue when I could see on occasion one to two trucks concurrently. And finally, on May 20th, 2010, I wrote to our city commissioners when I encountered four idling trucks parked at the same time as I and the other parents picked up our children from the preschool. The response that the city sent me was clear. There are no city laws to preclude this. We should continue to look at the unique situation proposed and develop guidelines that address the cumulative impacts and issue of many trucks at once in an area unsuitable for this kind of traffic. Nothing in House Bill 2081 addresses this situation. These drivers do not park longer than 5 minutes. This area is not designated a K-12 because it is a preschool. And there's no language in the House Bill 2081 to address the total number of vehicles allowed in any given street or area. Nothing in this bill addresses this unique problem, and I did attach the emails that I had sent to the city a year ago just so that you can know it's a real story. House Bill 2081 in its original form is a step in the right direction to acknowledge the adverse health impacts of idling diesel engines. It provides incentive and leadership to the trucking industry to improve best practices. What it does not do specifically is deal with the localized, dangerous health impacts of some of the most deadly category of emissions that I and my family, friends, and neighbors encounter with idling trucks in our community. As a first attempt, I'm realistic enough not to expect it to solve all these problems. I do, however, expect to address these problems through my local city commissioners who address zoning and nuisance, my county commissioners who address school safety and health, to be able to appropriately enact regulations that are in the best interest to protect public health. Things at times which can be as simple as requiring no idling signage to inform drivers they are in a high-impact zone, but which would be precluded by this law. I oppose the amendment, Section 6 specifically, because they do not only strip local government from jurisdiction, but they strip me as a citizen from the most easily accessible means of addressing problems due to idling trucks, that is, working with local government to find appropriate solutions to specific areas of concern, without offering any protection to Oregonians exposed to the nuisance and adverse health impacts associated with breathing diesel exhaust. I oppose House Bill 2081 in its original form because it does not meaningfully provide for the restriction of commercial vehicle idling around schools. I ask you to consider the question. Since the addition of these amendments, in essence, say to the people of Oregon, this is the best we can do to protect you from dangerous emissions associated with idling diesel and other commercial vehicles. Are you legislatures prepared to say this is the best we can do? If the answer is no, or even I don't know, please kill HB 2081 with its Section 6 amendments, or in the very least, pass HB 2081-9 that specifically requests the preemption of local jurisdiction amendments be removed, so that the citizens of Oregon can continue the important work of protecting our children from dangerous emissions. Thank you again.
Thank you. Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Allison Guzman. Can you hear me? I'm representing Centro Latino Americano. We're located on 944 West 5th Avenue in Eugene, Oregon. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today. So I'm the community coordinator for Centro Latino Americano. And if you don't know who we are, we're a social services organization based in West Eugene. Many of our clients and their extended families, friends, and neighbors are actually in Senator Chris Edwards' district. Centro is also an active partner in the Bethel Active Citizens Neighborhood Alliance, the River Road Neighborhood, the Train Song Neighborhood, and other local community groups that meet on a regular basis to work for better livability in West Eugene. So a big part of my work is to assist the families that live in West Eugene with their concerns related to family health. And they have a right to be concerned because residents are disproportionately exposed to diesel particulates due to the proximity, their proximity to the highways and the quality of the airshed, as Lisa Arkin mentioned earlier. The overarching concern expressed by the West Eugene families is the health of their children. Based on surveys and interviews we have conducted, our data is indicating that children in West Eugene have a much higher incidence of asthma than anywhere else in Lane County. In fact, our initial data is confirmed by asthma rates reported by the Bethel School District. The EPA and many highly respected scientific journals have proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that exposure to diesel particulates, one part of the air pollution that is emitted from commercial trucks, is an asthma trigger. In fact, when children are exposed to diesel particulate, their lungs cannot develop normally, and lung function is affected for their entire adult life. And we don't want that to happen, right? When a truck idles while waiting to load or unload, their air toxic emissions are increased, and the impact is most felt in the nearby neighborhoods. West Eugene is an industrial sector of the city where industry and homes are located in close proximity. I feel like I'm going in and out. Is this better? So I meet weekly with groups of mothers in their homes, at community centers, and at churches. And I'd like to tell you a little bit more of what the mothers of West Eugene and their stories and what they've shared with me. Mothers who I'm meeting with are very interested in learning about environmental health and are naturally very perceptive of their neighbor's health and have commented that while taking their children, for example, to the park, they've noticed that 4 out of the 5 kids there have asthma. I have also found in my experience speaking with them that it's easy for them to identify exposure to diesel particulates because of the smell. I've received complaints about highway fumes, nausea from breathing in diesel, and they note this especially in hot days such as the summers. So exposure to diesel is highly identifiable and cannot be ignored. But what's the good news? I'm finding that these mothers are just as concerned about their health and the health of their children and are willing to do something about it. This is not only an opportunity for them to become active in their community, but also gives them the mission to protect the health of their children as they grow and become leaders in our community. I personally feel, and I'm backed by many studies, that community-based participation, regardless of background, socioeconomic status, language, etc., combines knowledge, experience, and action, improving health outcomes and eliminate health disparities. So the mothers I work with are excited to become involved in activities that improve their health and the health of future generations. And Centro Latino Americano is helping them voice their concerns to our local government. This is why I came to testify before you today on HB 2081. Section 6 of this bill will make it illegal for my city or county to find localized solutions to reduce commercial truck idling. Without localized solutions, we can't have accurate data to support the needs of that particular community. Why use the cookie-cutter approach for the whole state if we know this approach is not as efficient as it appears? Cookie-cutter means, quote, and I quote, lacking individuality, stereotyped, or formulaic, which explains the January 1 date. It is just not logical for me to use a cookie-cutter and a grandfather approach for an issue that is not only complex, involved, and evolving, but also to use that approach in Oregon, as diverse as we are. Toxic air emissions are often a localized problem, and the best way to mitigate the adverse health effects in highly impacted neighborhoods will be through localized solutions. On behalf of Centro Latinoamericano, I want to express that we are grateful that the problem of commercial truck idling is being addressed in the state legislature. However, this bill is currently written as little to protect public health. I urge this committee to help Oregonians in urban areas everywhere, including West Eugene, by removing Section 6 of this bill, the language that precludes local governments from protecting citizens from toxic emissions from idling trucks, buses, and other commercial vehicles. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. See, I can see Senator Johnson here. I'm going to, we're going to recess on this bill and open a public hearing on HB 3335. Senator and your guest, would you like to come up?
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your patience. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. I apologize. We were actually in a work session on a budget, and thank you for your forbearance.
Keep the budgets moving.
That's a good thing. I am going to just use my time to introduce Mayor Jerry Cole of Rainier. Mayor Cole not only helped shepherd the city through one of the most difficult times in its history, he did so with remarkable grace and dignity, considering that Mayor Painter was a close personal friend. So acting as the comforter-in-chief for the city while dealing with his own grief at the loss of this brave police officer has been an extra trial on the mayor, and I'm going to let the mayor make the case for why this bill and the memorial that it represents is a fitting tribute to a fallen officer.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time. Just want to talk about Ralph.
Mayor, could I ask you to put your name on the record?
Yeah, I'm
please?
Sorry. Mayor Jerry Cole, mayor of Rainier, Oregon. I come here to support this bill today for Ralph and his family and the citizens of Rainier. Much has been said about Ralph's humor, his musical ability, his love of outdoors, how fast he could run, his dedication to his profession, and those who worked with him and those he served. I can say without a doubt that the most important role that Ralph lived was that of being a wonderful husband, father, and grandfather. Our conversations would always revolve around our families. Ralph meant a lot to the city of Rainier and the outlying communities. He grew up in St. Helens, Oregon, started out as a reserve there, and eventually came on full-time with Rainier. He served us for just about over 20 years, and the last 5 years as our police chief. The bill would rename a portion of Highway 30 between St. Helens and Rainier. And we thought that it would be fitting for the two communities, being that he was from there. I know, you know, I can't go without saying that there is a cost with some signage and stuff, and we do realize that there's several private donors out there that would be more than willing to help with that if needed. And I thank you for your time and would really appreciate your support with this bill.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one other thing. Today's a particularly fitting and poignant day to be hearing this bill. Today was the event that honored fallen officers, and I know that the chair and his community has been dealing with the line of duty death of another brave public safety officer in Eugene. And I know that this committee was eager to honor your officer as well. I think it is shocking that we have to, as communities, pay tribute to these fallen officers. It's getting more and more dangerous to be a police officer, and I just commend this bill to your consideration and hope that it moves out of the committee and onto the floor. And thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Does anybody have any... Senator Stark?
Just a comment. I just want to thank you for coming. Thank you for honoring Chief Painter in this way. Don't know him, but certainly watched the news reports about this man. Have friends that knew him well, knows the family. It's hard to honor a man, you know, that has such strong community roots and, you know, such strong support in the community. This is one small thing I think that we can do. And
thank you.
I appreciate you being here, and I appreciate you waiting through the hearing.
No problem.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time and patience.
Anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3354? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 3354. Senator Starr?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3354 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3354 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition? House Bill 3354 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Johnson, would you like to carry?
I'd be honored. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Okay, we have a few more people who wanted to speak on House Bill 2081. Is there anybody here today who can't be here next week? We've got a whole lot more discussion to go, and I'm out of time. Seeing none, we're going to I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2081. And we'll take that up again next week. And I'll very quickly, I understand this is short, open a public hearing on House Bill 2335. Richard, short version.
All right, so 2335 clarifies that federal funding received by the Oregon Department of Transportation for the purposes of highway workforce development refers to federal funding received each biennium. For the record, we have a letter from the Urban League of Portland in support, and there's no revenue and no fiscal.
Mr. Cobb.
Good afternoon, Senator and committee members. For the record, my name is Michael Cobb. I'm the manager of the Office of Civil Rights with the Oregon Department of Transportation. As you stated, this bill simply clarifies, it merely adds two words, this biennium. The agency had understood it to be that anyway. So, that end of my testimony.
Questions? Senator Girard, did you have a question?
No.
Oh, I thought I seen you reaching for the mic. Okay. Is there anybody else who would like to? I never know, Senator.
You never know.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2335? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on 2335. Chair moves House Bill 2335 to the floor with a due pass motion. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? No. House Bill 2335 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Edwards, would you carry that?
Sure.
And with that, Senators,
Senator, we are... could I vote on that fallen officer thing?
You sure could. We'll open a work...
No, you suspend the rules.
Huh?
That's
what we're doing. What's the motion, Jim?
Suspend the rules to allow me to vote on House Bill.
Chair moves to suspend the rules to allow Senator Burdick to vote on House Bill 3354. Is there any objection? There is none. Senator, how do you vote?
Aye. Thank you.
Senator Burdick votes aye. Close on that. We will close for the day.